Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies.
Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at SchoolSucksShow. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username SchoolSucksPodcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
So I have tons of practical advice for people listening to your podcast who just want to live a better life, despite the fact that school sucks.
Hey, everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to School Sucks. Today is March 13th, and I'm very excited to bring you an information and action-packed show with Dr. Brian Kaplan. He is a professor of economics at George Mason University. His new book is called The Case Against Education, and you say, I like education. Me too. That's why we're here together. The subtitle to this book, of course, is Why the Education System is a Waste of Time and Money, and we'll go into the title and so much more in great detail in the show. I was really, really happy with how much we packed into less than an hour. Brian is also the father of two homeschooled boys doing a very different kind of homeschooling. And we talked about this after the interview. I might be bringing them on the show in the near future. I'm excited about that as well. So I want to get to this as quickly as possible. I do just want to mention Patreon. We are $7 per content item away from reaching a very lofty goal that I set a few months ago. And once this goal is achieved, we will, very shortly after this goal is achieved, we'll be launching a weekly bonus show, subscriber-only show. You might remember I did some polling on ideas. I am on the edge of my seat. I'm so excited to get started on that project. And also, while I'm asking you to do things, one more thing. You know, one of the things that's been a challenge for me, really, my entire adult life, when, you know, starting a new romantic relationship or interacting with a new group of friends, I always encountered this frustration. It's something like, gosh, it's going to take so long for this woman or for this group of people to fully realize how enjoyable I actually am. And I worry about that with all of you, too, especially you newer listeners. Fortunately, in this age of information and social media, there is now a fast track to fully grasping my enjoyability, and it is Instagram. You can search Brett Vinat or School Sucks Project on Instagram, and you will find me. Of all the things that people are outraged about right now, the fact that there are less than 1,000 followers on this Instagram page, add that to your list of outrages, please. But we're going to need our followers in four digits if anyone is ever going to take me seriously there. I should also probably stop doing things like pointing my camera at a streetlight and saying it's the moon. So we each have responsibilities here. I don't do that. You go and follow me. So today's show, a lot of recurring themes explored from new angles. Please check the show notes or go to schoolsucksproject.com for related podcasts. All right, everybody, without further ado, let's get right to it. Here's my conversation with Dr. Brian Kaplan. If you enjoy listening to Brian, and if you're not insane, you will. You can check out more of his work at bcaplan.com. That's bcaplan.com. Thanks for listening. Here we go. Hey, Brian, thanks for joining me.
My pleasure to be here.
All right, so we are going to discuss your book, The Case Against Education. When I first encountered this, the title, it struck me as kind of unfortunate. And what I mean by that is we have worked hard for years on my show to make a clear distinction between schooling and education, being education is this lifelong pursuit. It is intrinsically motivated first and self-directed second. Schooling is institutionalized. It's often indoctrination. It uses this idea that pupils are essentially useless until authorities can put useful things into them and turn them into useful beings. So it's a very important separation for us. And, you know, I read the title. I said, oh, you could have said schooling. Then as I dug more into your work, I realized you're like a master of provocative titles. You even provoked me. So I wanted to just to get a little personal story from you. You are extremely well-schooled. You're a PhD from Princeton, but you're also very well-educated. How do you make that distinction over your, what, 40 years in in school in one form or another?
Yeah. So I've been in school continuously since I was 5 years old. Of course, I'm mostly self-educated, and that's the truth. If I only learned what I was taught in class, or if I only knew what I was taught in class, I couldn't write these books. I barely know anything, really. Mm-hmm. So much of my education is just reading in the library or just free reading. Most of it actually is happening before the internet. As a researcher, the stuff that I can get on the internet makes my life so much easier. But being on a college campus, I still could have gotten it the other way too.
Right.
So much better. In terms of why I chose the title, main reason is I don't like to argue about words. If most people think a word means something and that's what they have in their mind, then I just like to run with it rather than.
Right.
Here's the title of the book. Before we can even talk, we have to go and get you to stop using the words education and schooling to mean the same thing because they're really different things. And when I think of that, I'm just like, I don't think someone doesn't want to hear that. I just want to go and start with people where they are. In the book, I do in a way wind up making the distinction, although it's also true that there is sort of an ideology of education itself being the most important thing in the universe. And I am going against that, especially the idea of if somebody doesn't want it, they should still get it.
Of course.
It's true that in the book, I'm not just talking about school, about schooling itself. So there is an idea that to a large extent, education more broadly conceived is usually not being pursued for intrinsic value and instead is a way of showing off or impressing employers. Even stuff that people do outside of school is often really ultimately seen as being another stepping stone towards doing well later in school. So there is that.
Right. So that kind of leads us into the thesis for this book. And I think a big part of this work that you've done is kind of a response to this college for all mentality or college for all movement, that this is just going to create endless opportunities for everybody, whether they're fit for college or not. Mm-hmm. But, the thesis that you...
What do you mean everyone's fit for college?
Exactly. I mean, that kind of egalitarian idea, and we see the problems that that's causing, the social problems that it's causing on a lot of campuses across the country. And it has been for years where people, in this whole social justice movement, people feel really out of place. I've talked a lot with Professor Thaddeus Russell about this. I'm sure you're somewhat familiar with his work, and he was on the Occidental campus when a lot of action unfolded there. And, he's been saying, this is part of this idea that everybody needs to be fed into college as some kind of equality or social justice project. And it's having really, really negative results, ironically, but isn't this always the case for the people that it is most designed, kind of ham-fistedly designed to help? So, the thesis that you're putting forward is that right now, civilized, technologically advanced, first world societies revolve around the education system. And you're suggesting that there is a better way to do this. Right now, what's happening is this idea that everyone gets a college degree and there'd be great jobs. That's not true. What we have instead is a kind of runaway credential inflation. And you write, trying to spread success with education spreads education, but not success. So what is this idea of credential inflation?
So it's the idea that if you just go and compare the amount of education that you need to get a job, not do a job, but get a job, it's risen tremendously over the last 70 years. So, roughly by a full degree.
Mm-hmm.
So in the book, I talk a lot about sociologists, especially, who have gone and just compared how much education would a waiter at a fancy restaurant have today versus a long time ago, or the concierge at a nice hotel, or just go down a bunch of very mundane jobs. And you'll see that now these workers would have a lot more, and it would be hard for them to get the job in many cases if they didn't have that education. So it's sort of this puzzle, what's going on? The approximate cause is, there's a lot more people who have the education, then employers can be a lot more picky.
Mm. Right.
But then, you know, this does sort of push it back and say, yeah, but why is it they're so picky? Why don't they just go and settle for what you need rather than ratcheting up the standards? And that's where really the heart of the book comes in and says, well, one of the main reasons why employers value education isn't for the skills that it is actually poured into you, but rather just as a form of certification. They like the education because it's a way where you jump through hoops. And if you jump through a lot of hoops, then you're impressive. But if everyone's jumping through lots of hoops, then you need to jump through even more hoops to be impressive. So back when most people didn't have a high school degree is impressive.
Yeah.
Now high school degree is no longer very impressive. And now you need to get a bachelor's degree or a master's degree in order to get employers to take you seriously. So, again, it's sort of a, you know, rat race or a treadmill story where the more education people have, the more that you need. And, basically there's this contrast between the normal story about why education pays, which is this skill creation theory. It just says that you go to school and skill is poured into you. And it's not entirely wrong.
Right.
So, you know, people learn literacy and numeracy in school, but it's so incomplete. What about all the other stuff that you learn in school that you're never going to need to know again? Why do employers care about that? Why does it matter if you're one Aristotle class short of graduation? And this alternative signaling story explains that. And then very nicely predicts credential inflation, which is precisely what we've seen.
Indeed. So what's being signaled here is essentially conformity. That's what it's still in a lot of these more bureaucratic forms of employment. That's what employers want to see. And the college degree, I mean, the high school degree used to be sufficient. Mm-hmm. I've always said on this show that, you know, the three hidden lessons of school are number one, obedience, number two, conformity, and number three, you know, those first two lessons produce a kind of philosophical, political, you know, even just general intellectual kind of apathy. Because if you obey, you know, you don't really have to be self-directed. If you conform, you really don't have to be self-assertive. So apathy is kind of the natural result of that. So college, for many employers, seems like almost a form of certification in the ability to conform.
Right. I mean, I think that overstates it a bit. So in the book, I say there's really a trio of traits that you're signaling with your education. So you're signaling like intelligence, work ethic, and conformity. The conformity is important because, we'll just back up. So think about this. So the most conformist person in the world, if he's extremely stupid and lazy, still wouldn't do well in school.
Sure.
So you do need this combination. But I do say the conformity is the thing that you're signaling that really explains why the system is so rigid, so inflexible, so unfair. Because, you know, here's the thing. If someone comes along and says, oh, I have a great new radical way of signaling conformity, well, who are the first people in line to try that idea? It's going to be the nonconformists.
Exactly.
So that's the problem, is we get this lock-in. And again, you could see this lock-in in lots of areas of life. Like, why is it that we know that people aren't going to start wearing kimonos to work?
Right.
It's like the suit. What a stupid thing to wear. But like, it's very locked in, because who wants to be the first person who goes to a job interview in a kimono, or, you know, dressed in a Star Trek uniform or something?
Right.
I mean, these are all things where, like, you know, once something is established as the normal thing that you're supposed to do in a society, it's pretty hard to break out of that.
Yeah.
Of course, $1 trillion of government subsidies on the side of the status quo aren't very helpful. But like, in terms of what employers are wanting, one of the main things they're looking for is conformity. And there's a lot to what you're saying about how this has these unfortunate political consequences. But at the same time, like, it's very hard to understand how you would run a large business without a lot of conformity.
Yes.
You know, you can't have every employee showing up and saying, hey, I should be in charge. I'm doing it my way. Well, you know, like you are part of a team, and there is a reason why big corporations generally generally run most of the economy, which is that they are good at what they do. They are good at forging a bunch of individual humans into a well-oiled machine that produces a lot of stuff. You do have the option of being self-employed, but generally your pay is going to be a lot lower than if you just go and commit yourself to a well-functioning team.
Sure.
So it's functional. I mean, again, I will say that, you know, very conformist people aren't very fun to me. If I just go through my mental Rolodex of friends, most of my favorite people are highly nonconformist. And yet, if I were starting a business, I wouldn't hire them.
right. You know, when I was reading that part, it reminds me of this book. Have you ever heard of a book called Disciplined Minds by a physicist named Jeff Schmidt?
I don't think so.
It's interesting. So, you know, he's spent his career in higher education as well. And he wrote this book that was really damning about the whole higher education experience, mostly focused on scientific medical professionals as the process of basically breaking people and getting them to adjust to the status quo of a certain industry. The book lays out a very convincing case. It was really influential for me when I first read it maybe a few years ago. And you'll have to deal, like, over the next half hour with a fair amount of, like, cynicism and suspicion from me. But yeah, I was just interested if you had ever read that book, where it's basically trying to cleanse any unwanted creativity or head off at the past the emergence of a innovative subculture inside the medical industry or certain, you know, economics, scientific pursuits. But it's an interesting read, and I think it's a slightly more suspicious and intense version of some of the things that you're saying. So I just didn't know if you'd ever encountered that book.
Right. So no, I hadn't. Again, you know, I guess the main thing is that, you know, like I'm pretty nonconformist myself, although I'm very strategic about it. So that's how I managed to get all this education. Is I'm always looking for cracks in the system and chinks in the armor and saying, well, do I really have to do this, or could I weasel out of it? Because I don't like that doesn't sound very good. And when I can weasel, I weasel. But on the other hand, when it says no, this is a rigid system. You want to be a professor, you have to do the following 17 steps. It's like, all right, fine. All right, what's the first step?
Right.
And I'll get doing it. But again, like, you know, so like, you know, for the like the effects of conformism, you know, it's always worth pointing out that most nonconformists with new ideas have bad ideas.
Right.
You know, the way that innovation happens is, but first you need to learn what's really going on currently and understand it on a deep level, and then maybe you'll see, ah, it doesn't really have to be this way. There's an improvement. But when, you know, when a usual nonconformist looks at a well-functioning system and says, ah, this is so stupid, I can fix it, normally they're just completely wrong and they don't know what they're talking about.
Right, that's true.
So, you know, like you know, it's important to realize that, like whatever distaste that you have for conformism, and I'll admit I've got plenty of it, like you need to do step back and realize it does have this social function. It does play a useful role in a lot of cases, even if it also leads concentration camps to work, which is for two, which is – so it's – you know, it's a complicated thing to realize, well, to have a well-functioning organization to, like, you know, conformity puts food on the table. Like, you know, you can't have a cucumber picker saying, I'm going to have my own totally different way of doing the cucumbers. It's going to be a disaster if every cucumber picker has his own opinion on it. But at the same time, like, it does lead to terrible things too. And like it's just like you got to go and accept the cognitive dissonance of, wow, there's this trait which has a lot of great uses, but also leads to bad things. And then it's rammed down the throats of innocent children. But if they don't learn it, when are they going to learn it? So, all of this is lurking in the background of my thinking.
Right. And I think that it's something that we've talked a lot about on my show as individuals, certainly as liberty-minded individuals. There's always, you know, this effort to strike a balance between wanting to be innovative or outside of the box, but also this recognition, something that, you know, a lot of certainly libertarian or voluntarist ANCAP activists have failed to recognize, that this society exists all around it. And most people are living in it in an I don't want to say uncritical, but they're certainly not questioning every aspect of it all the time.
And, just say uncritical. Uncritical is the right word, I think. What else do you call it?
Right. But if you ever want to be able to be persuasive, you have to recognize that, you know, that you have to balance the reality of living in that world with any innovative or nonconformist thinking that you have. I'm sure that that's something that you have to deal with in higher education.
Yeah, sure. I mean, if you just think about all the libertarians who want to be entrepreneurs and like what it actually takes to succeed, you know, very good rule of thumb. The people who've worked in an industry for years and then decide they want to be entrepreneurs in that industry, that's the best bet. The people who know nothing about it and just sort of show up, I've got great ideas. Like, those people are useless. What are they going to do? They don't know anything.
Right.
My brother, someone who had like endless entrepreneurial ideas, and they like every one of them is like, that's not going to work. And none of them worked until finally he worked in industry for a few years and learned a lot about it and made connections. And then he was able to do something with it.
Right. So I want to jump back to the college for all mentality that I think was one of your motivations. Responding to that was a motivation for writing this book. Is that correct?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So there's actually this great internet meme that says when everyone has a BA, no one does.
Exactly.
And yeah, that's exactly there. Yeah. So when people think, well, we get all of these great college type jobs if we all had college, it's even now a lot of people with college degrees don't have what you'd think of as a college type job. So, you know, I also talk about, in addition, sort of the flip side of credential inflation is what's called malemployment, which is people who have a job, you know, they have a college degree, but they work in a Foot Locker or something like that. And that's also very common, right? So you can always, when the education levels are higher, the more we go up, the main result is just that you're more likely to wind up at a job where it doesn't seem matched to the education or the background that you've had.
Right.
And again, if everyone had a college degree, of course, then garbage would be taken out by people with college degrees, and dishes would be cleaned and washed by people with college degrees.
Yeah, and as I've watched what happens, or what is continuing to happen in college culture, like really over the last 5 years, and I think it's really intensified over the last two or three, as far as like the emergence of these always in flux kind of social science programs that a lot of people are studying, like all you need is this 4-year degree, that this is still the ticket. So, you know, the choice of major, the path towards, you know, being useful vocationally seems to be lower on people's lists of priorities, even though they're investing all this money. You know, my conspiratorial thinking about this, telling everybody they need to go to college, is it just like some mission to produce a useless society of left-wing ideologues? Because, you know, it's not – so many people are going and they're spending all this money and they're going to all this debt. It's not increasing their usefulness or their, you know, employability. But one thing that certainly happened to me 18 years ago when I graduated from a 4-year program in communications – before I realized I had to go back to school, or I thought I had to go back to school, my usefulness did not increase, but my sense of entitlement went through the roof. Mm. You know, I felt really, really entitled going to job interviews, just assuming that it was like an exchange. Like, I show you this piece of paper, you show me where my desk is, you know, that was, you know, really frustrating and disappointing.
This might be a function of being at George Mason, but I would say that our students don't have any big sense of entitlement. Mm. I mean, it's more along the lines of desperately hunting to get an internship so that you can actually get some job experience. There's a lot of students who, you know, probably feel fairly low status, and like, you know, again, because, you know, a lot of it is the reference group. So they're competing with people from better schools, and, you know, and they have a sense of, you know, like, this degree is not as desired. I mean, we're in a high wage part of the country, so that probably helps. But I would say that, you know, students, you know, seem, you know, like, you know, very apathetic most of the time. And, you know, like, you know, it's very unusual that a student comes and like acts like they know everything, or they're automatically going to be given great rewards. There's more of a sense of, I could do this whole program and still not get a good job, which makes more sense as the rank of the school goes down. I would say that, like, for students at good schools, I mean, it's not that they have no skills. It's just that the skills were not really enhanced very much in school, right? And especially they have a lot of potential. So, again, like, the way that I like to think about it is, a lot of what goes on in college is that you convince employers that you're worthy of training. So when you emerge, it's not like you actually know how to do anything, but they can say, all right, well, we're going to give this training to some people, and if, given how well you've done in school, you seem like a good prospect, you're probably going to be able to learn what we have to teach you. So, you know, even just knowing that I'm the kind of person that employers want to train, I can kind of see that giving people some sense of satisfaction. And indeed, I'd say, is in a better world where there's less education, you could get that satisfaction at a much earlier age. You could say, oh, well, high school, now I'm done with that. Now I'm ready to go and get a good job, which is the world that we used to have. And what I argue in the book is, there's no reason why we couldn't still have that world, really.
Indeed. And I think what you're saying kind of relates to the what's going to be a frequent counter argument to what you say in the book, the idea of the education premium that those with a bachelor's degree earn, I think it was like almost 75% more than those who have a high school diploma. And that's up like considerably since the 1970s. But one of the arguments that we've been making every time this comes up on my show is that that's really correlative and not causative, that people who get the 4-year degree, just because that is a very much a societal norm. It has been for several decades now. College is a stop on a path to success that person was already on. Success, finger quotes, success, you know, I mean, at least employability, at least, you know, higher earnings, that college education is an aspect of, you know, a successful person's path, but it's not the cause of success.
Right. Well, what I say is that, you know, both extreme views are wrong. So there's the extreme view that all 75% is causal, and that's wrong. The idea that there's no causal effect also, like, again, when you look at the data, it's almost impossible to conclude that. So basically, my preferred story is that about, you know, a little bit more than half of the observed effect, or the observed difference in earnings, is causal. But again, like you know, there's a lot of ways that you, a lot of signs of this. I mean, the simplest thing is just go and try to match people up by their characteristics, like their test scores before they started, and then see how much of if you do compare apples to apples, compare two people with the same SAT score, but one finished college, one didn't. How much is the difference in earnings on average going to be? So that'll give you that result. If you just look at the extreme difference in earnings between people with 3 years of college and four.
Right.
I mean, like it's very hard to understand that as not being causal. It's like, well, it really does seem like if you are just a one class short of graduation, that you are treated far worse in the labor market than if you could just go and get and complete that one class. So that seems like it's a big deal. And again, probably just as a pure signal of conformity there, where it's like, look, our society says 4 years. It didn't say 3.95 years, said 4.0 years. So right. If you don't do what society says, then you're going to get punished. There's also some really neat work on things like the reward to IQ depending upon your education and how long you've been working. So as you might expect, the longer you're in the labor force, the greater the reward that you get for your IQ. So basically, when you're right out of school, then you generally get a smaller benefit. Or maybe or like for high school, it seems like you get no benefit at all. Employers just say you are a high school student of some sort. But you know, very smart people with high school degrees, they do actually, grow. You know, their earnings rise at an unusually fast rate. But still, it takes many years for them to start getting full credit or anything close to full credit for their intelligence. What's striking is that for college graduates, it seems like you start getting a lot, most of the credit for your intelligence right after graduation. Mm-hmm. But if you either didn't finish or you didn't go to college at all, then 10 years, 20 years in order to get anything like full credit for your intelligence. So again, it seems like a lot of what's going on is that if you're smart and then you jump through all the right hoops, then the world officially acknowledges that you've got talent. But on the other hand, if you try to cut corners, then you spend a decade or more convincing people, hey, I didn't do the normal thing, but I am smart. Give me some credit for what I'm able to do. So I would say that seems to be some pretty strong evidence that what's going on is causal, but in a complex and subtle way, which, basically among economists, I have to go and convince them that a lot of the effect isn't causal. Or again, especially among labor economists and education economists that they're so into the idea. But on the other hand, with critics of education, I usually have to spend some work saying, the extreme view is wrong, but it's also not true that there's no causal benefit. And in fact, it sure seems like there's still a pretty solid one. And I'd say, again, the main reason why education turns out to be a bad financial investment isn't that it doesn't pay well. It still pays pretty well, but that so many people don't finish. So it's more of a question of it would pay well if you finish, but a lot of people aren't going to finish. And that's the real case where you can say it's not a good investment. But if someone is on track to finish, that's where I would say I would encourage almost anyone, well, to stick with it. You're almost done, and then you get this big bag of money.
Do you see any evidence or any promise that there might be more rewards in the near future for people who are shortcutting? The reason why I ask is the last guest I had on the show, his name was Derek McGill. He's the director of marketing for a company called Praxis. Are you familiar with Praxis?
I'm familiar with Praxis. Yeah, Isaac Morehouse, a good friend of mine.
What you're describing here, in some ways, like going to the 4-year finish and getting the degree is an accelerator, just as far as earnings are concerned. And, I'm just thinking back to the conversation that I had with Derek. I had it with Zach Slabeck. I had it with Isaac, all on the show. But this idea that, a lot of people, and I guess this is more related to the people who are just kind of stuck there, or they're not going to finish, or they're taking 5 or 6 years to complete a 4-year degree. It's kind of like a rotary. And things like Praxis are an overpass, above that rotary. But I don't know how popular that idea can really be. I want to think it's going to become enormously popular, even though I love Praxis. I hope they have lots of competition. But I haven't seen too much evidence that fast tracking is going to be rewarded in the context of, everything that we've been talking about with signaling conformity to more bureaucratic, large corporation type employers.
So I think we're basically on the same page. I want it to be successful. I think it's an interesting idea, but I wouldn't expect it to actually pose any significant threat to the existing system. I can see these alternatives like gradually becoming like 5 or 10% of the market. Mm-hmm. And that would be a huge improvement for some people and would be a tremendous financial gain for people like Isaac. So I mean, basically there's two perspectives. There's the perspective of, will it transform the education system? And that's where I would bet strongly against it. And then there's this, can it be a successful business model? And that could be, and that's much more likely, right? You know, imagine that Isaac winds up having 0.1% of people that go to college instead go through his system.
Right, right.
That would be a point, you know, 1 in 1,000 would still be an enormously successful business model. He would be centimillionaire anyway, if not a billionaire. Mm-hmm. And good for him. I hope it all works out for him.
Indeed. Now, related to that, how about competition for standard higher education from online education? Like we see there's this explosion of, you know, Jordan Peterson, I mentioned my friend Thaddeus Russell, who are trying to move, you know, their curriculum away from these institutions and to a more accessible place. But obviously there's the credentialing problem still seems to exist, you know, the way colleges are accredited to be able to, you know, give people college credit or ultimately a piece of paper that says they completed some kind of program, that there's a real racket to that as far as like how accreditation works and what accreditation is available for online institutions. Do you see anything promising emerging as far as competition for online higher education outside of, you know, like whatever, the University of Phoenix?
Yeah, again, I can see this becoming a small niche, which is great for some people. I'm very skeptical that it's going to pose much competition to traditional colleges. Again, you know, like if it's just a matter of your accreditation, so on, Jordan Peterson could say, hey, I'm setting up the Jordan Peterson accreditation system. And I accredit myself and I accredit the following other people. The main problem is, will employers take it seriously? And I think that, again, that's highly unlikely, primarily because of this conformity signaling thing that I'm talking about, where the very fact that you're doing this unusual thing makes employers nervous, and understandably so.
Right.
So my view is, you know, really what online education is, it's a fantastic form of edutainment. It competes with blogs.
Sure.
It doesn't compete with school with regular schools. So yeah, you know, like, you know, it's a wonderful way for people to go and get enlightenment, and also it doesn't have to be when you're young. You can get it at any point in your life, like so you can get it whenever you want. But very little sign that it's going to help you get a job or raise your earnings, right? And yeah, you know, so basically, if what you want out of online education is to do what Napster did to the record industry, then I think that's wishful thinking.
Yeah,
if instead you want to do what YouTube did for classical music, where anyone who wants classical music can listen to an unlimited amount for free forever, then then online education is great at that. So, you know, like, I mean, I do tons of online education myself. So, I mean, I'm a blogger. I think of this as online education. I put tons of educational resources up for free, but I don't see any sign that this stuff will get people jobs. It's something where if you're doing the regular route, then you can learn a lot more useful stuff. So at least the system doesn't penalize you for doing a regular bachelor's degree plus reading my blog.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So that's the good news, is that at least it's not considered a bad mark against you that you're doing online education in addition to regular. But of course, what most people want is not the enlightenment; they want the credential. And for that, I don't see much sign that that what's happening is going to make much difference. Most of the online education that's going on seems to be that the college itself offers some online options.
But
essentially, this just means that the students are ignoring the professor from their dorm room instead of ignoring the professor in the lecture hall. Big deal.
Sure. So two responses to that. First, like the Praxis model and this idea of building a better credential than the college degree, like self-directed people building their own credentials is a big part of that idea. And they show people how to do that. But the bigger part of that, that I hope more online educators would be able to replicate, is creation of a network, right? Or Praxis is kind of like a bridge between students who are eager, motivated, self-directed, want an alternative to traditional college. It's a bridge between them and employers who are receptive to that kind of person. And I think that's a very good thing. And I think that's very replicatable. I mean, that's more aspirational, but I hope it happens. The second part of that, as far as competing with college, you know, I talked to Professor William Boies from the University of Arizona And, you know, he's been in the system for, I think, 40 plus years. And he says this has a decade or two left max. It can't continue in this form. I mean, do you really think that higher education as it is, with the inflating costs and, you know, all of the increasing doubts about the effectiveness of it, do you think this can just go on and on and on?
So, I mean, I think the cost will eventually plateau. Anything that rises faster than GDP can't go on forever. Okay. But yeah, I think in 10 or 20 years, the system is basically going to be the same as it currently is.
Yeah.
Two things. First of all, there's hundreds of billions of dollars of taxpayer money poured on top of the status quo every year. So this is not like the record industry or travel agencies. I mean, those are areas where if they stop fulfilling consumer desires, then they go out of business. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that's not how higher education works. There's all this taxpayer support. So you'd actually have to change taxpayers' minds and get taxpayers to say higher education is a waste of money. And I see no sign that that's going on. In fact, this is an extremely unpopular view, always has been. Again, it's possible that the public is going to turn around all of a sudden, but I would always bet against that. I just say, like, things generally continue the way they're continuing. And again, especially when it's not your money.
Right.
It's the taxpayer's money. Well, taxpayer cannot unilaterally reduce his tax bill by changing his mind about whether education is worth government support. And that's really the key psychological lever to consider. It's one thing if there's a product that's junk and if you don't want it, you stop buying it and you save the money. And that's a case where we can really rely upon, really, at least there's a good chance that people eventually wise up. But on the other hand, if it's you have to pay taxes whether you want it or not, and now do you think that it's a good idea? This is where Stockholm syndrome is very strong, and just what I call social desirability bias. The idea, oh well, they're trying to go and educate people, so isn't this wonderful? And isn't this this is the most important way to spend our money and that kind of stuff. And then again, like, you know, there's just this lock in from the conformity, which I think is a big deal as well, right? So I mean, like as to why it is that it can't continue. Remember, the system is about 1,000 years old. So, like, as to why it would suddenly go away. If you go and look at drawings of early universities, they look almost exactly the same as drawings of modern classrooms with, like, the sage on the stage and the other people going and copying the stuff down.
You
know, before they're copying it in wax rather than on paper, because they don't have paper. But otherwise, it's pretty much the same thing. So, I mean, I do have a bet on this, by the way. So back in 2009, I made a bet, public bet, that the share of 18 to 24 year olds that are enrolled in traditional 4-year colleges would fall by no more than 10% over the next 10 years. Mm-hmm. And I'm totally on track to win this. In fact, the share has gone up.
Right. Right. Yeah.
Here's the thing. Once you realize that people are not there for the knowledge, the fact that there's a better way to teach them stuff is not really important.
Hmm.
And then it's just a matter of, is there some other credential that's going to take its place? And again, when you combine the massive government subsidies with the fact that people are there to signal conformity, and so if you do something weird, you're signaling nonconformity, I think you have the recipe for a very stable system. Here's the thing, is like most people like write a book like mine and then they want to end with hope. I just want to end with a reasonable forecast. I mean, if it's reasonable to have hope, then hope. If it's not reasonable, then not hope.
Right.
That's what I always try to do, is to separate my predictions from my hopes. So, I mean, I don't know if you know this, but I'm very prominent as a public bettor. I bet people on things all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And right now my track record is 17 wins, 0 losses. So I will claim to have some, I will stick my neck in and say my judgment just seems to be better than most people's, and I've got the numbers to back that up. So yeah, I don't see much change happening. You know, like marginal changes. So again, if someone sort of weasels out and says, well, it's not going to continue in its current form, all right, well, how much would it have to change in order to no longer be considered its current form?
Okay, sure.
If a third of classes are being taught in dorm rooms through online, but you still go to a brick and mortar school, you still the current markets and market leaders are still the same. The cost is still going to be very similar because, you know, as long as you actually go to college and you have all these buildings and everything else, having some of your classes online barely saves any money. So why? No reason to think that's going to drive costs down.
Right.
So
right.
Yeah. So I mean, there's going to be changes, and there'll be the majors may adjust somewhat. But again, like, you know, if it would still be recognizable today, and if basically the market leaders are still pretty much the market leaders, then I'll say, you know, that's what I think a reasonable forecast. Although, again, maybe Isaac Morehouse will go and people like him will peel 5 or 10% off of the current system, and I hope they do. But that's not going to drive the system into the ground.
So that leads me to, I think, two final questions. The first one might be setting me up for a little bit of disappointment here, but the idea of how to thrive in a system that's probably not going to change, right? As individuals, take your advice and make better choices for themselves as far as their educational futures are concerned. Most people, we have to face the fact, and you know, you're betting against this, are not going to change, or you're betting for that most people are not going to change their behavior. So those who do, and I know Tom Woods put this question to you a month ago, are going to have a competitive disadvantage, it would seem, right? Even though they might have a chance to start adult life earlier. But, you know, in a lot of the recent conversations that I've had and basically the ideas that I push on my show generally, I feel like maybe I'm being a little bit too optimistic or flowery about certain things, like just pursue entrepreneurship. That's, you know, I love to share those great stories, but there's the truth is that might not be for everybody. You know, I left my well-paying job 4 years ago to pursue this web project full time, and I'm still not even sure that it's right for me. You know, I'm doing it, but I question that all the time. So I don't want to give like really general advice like, look, just cut your own path, be an entrepreneur. But, you know, there is a surefire way to at least upfront save $100,000 by not getting a 4-year degree. But what does that mean in a world where so many people are just going to trudge through that? And even if they don't come out smarter or more equipped for the professional world on the other side, you know, they still have the signal that, you know, a nonconformist, more frugal person doesn't.
Right. So I have tons of practical advice for people listening to your podcast who just want to live a better life, despite the fact that the system, despite the fact that school sucks. All right. So K through 12, that's really hard on because you have so few choices. There's so many rules. I mean, you know, so like, you know, like we could talk about that, but college is really easy to improve your experience. Just to start in terms of saving money, I would just say, you know, like, so just go to the best public school you can get into. It's way cheaper than private school. And for most jobs, it barely matters. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's a whole body of research on how much does the selectivity of your college matter. And the answer is it's greatly overrated, actually. Much more important to choose a major wisely than to get into it, than to go to a really good school. So, and in terms of majors, you know, for, you know, there's a bunch of standard high paying ones that are a lot of work, like engineering, computer science. And then there is one standout major that is very high paying and requires actually very little work. And that's economics. Right. So I hope I build up enough credibility for saying things that are contrary to my own interests and wishes to be believed when I say, yeah, I'm an econ professor and the econ professor is a ridiculously good deal.
Yeah.
Right. So the amount of work that you need to do is barely higher than in other humanities and social sciences. But the pay that econ majors get is almost as good as engineers and computer scientists. It's fantastic. So you go like, you know, per dollar of work, econ is a ridiculously good deal because, basically you go to college, you have your 4-year party and you learn some economics a little bit. And then you get on average, you get a very good job. So that's step one is, you know, you do need to have a little bit of math, but not that much for the undergraduate. For, you know, if you want to continue in grad school, which is also a very good deal, then you need more math. But, you know, undergraduate, just like, you know, your high school, just like your, you know, like very minimal calculus is all you need to do very well with as an econ undergraduate. Again, you're not getting a lot of job skills in general, unless you want to be an economics professor, but still you're getting, you're studying some interesting stuff. You're not doing much work and you're getting good money. In terms of other things that you can do, I am just I'm not really amazed, but I feel like I should be amazed at how little effort college students make to get something out of their time there. So, you know, like the number of students who go and visit the professors and talk to them, very few. Plenty of times I go a whole semester, no student ever bothers to come over to my office. Right. You know, so, you know, like most professors, like they know something. And they have office hours. You can go and talk to them for free for hours and hours if you want to. And it doesn't even matter if you're their student. right? You can go and try to meet any professor on your campus that you think is an interesting person. So, you know, like I'm homeschooling my older son. So what I always tell them is, look, just go to the faculty list, scroll through, find anyone that you think might be interesting and spend 5 minutes to meet them. How hard is
sure.
that?
Sure. Yeah, I bet right? a lot of them would love it.
Yeah. I mean, you know, so and like I think a lot of people are shy or they're like they don't want me to come there. And I say, look, you have any idea how bored and lonely most professors are? The fact most students are just if they come to their office just to be there to beg for a grade, you know, for someone to come there with some sincere interest and curiosity, there's so many people who get that once a year, once every 5 years, and they'd be so grateful. And here you've met a person who has a lot of knowledge, who might be interesting, at least in their area, and who could help you in the future. Like they could write you a letter of recommendation. They may have something, you know, there's a lot of useful advice they'd be able to give you. So try that. You know, like auditing classes and, you know, down the library, there's tons of stuff in the library. You can just go and read stuff there. Students, it's a little bit harder to go and meet the really good students. I mean, there's tons around, but how do you find them? But, you know, like just like be friendly to people and to like introduce yourself to people. Anytime there's a student in a class who seems like they have a good comment, just try to introduce them yourself to them and make friends.
Right.
You know, this is all very basic advice, which hardly anyone follows. So, you know, like do it. Like, why not? What do you got to lose?
Yeah, absolutely. That's really, really well said. And I just want to put in a plug for the book with one enticement for my audience. Originally, I wanted to go through several statistics and studies, but since we're pressed for time, can you think of one? The book references a lot of them, but mm-hmm. one particularly damning study or statistic that encourages you to bet against this changing in the future, or that was a real motivator to write this book and make this case in general, something that stuck out for you?
Hmm. So probably not any one study. I mean, again, like, so, I mean, my whole view is that no one study is all that good. Right?
Mm-hmm.
It's just like one article. So like how convincing can it really be? I mean, again, this is to me one of the most frustrating things about my fellow economists is that rather than read 100 papers and form a judgment, they want to find the one silver bullet paper since this paper showed it so convincingly, I don't have to read anything else that anyone's ever written again. It's like, no, you do, right? That one, like no paper is really that good or convincing. But the main thing that stuck with me is just if you just go and look at the numbers on the curriculum and just see what a small fraction of people's time is spent on anything that they might plausibly use.
Right.
And then on top of that, just see how little knowledge adults actually retain. Not only do you study a bunch of subjects that you're never going to need to know again, but usually people forget them pretty soon after the final exam, and yet it pays. So again, the single fact, I think it's this: the fraction of adult Americans who claim to speak a foreign language very well.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so typical to spend 2 or 3 years of required K through 12 on foreign language. And yet, you know, so what fraction of adult Americans do you think claim, self-reported, to be able to speak a foreign language very well, that they learned how to speak a foreign language very well in school? What fraction of Americans do you think would say that?
25.
lower.
12.
A lot lower.
Is self-reporting?
As I learned to speak a foreign language very well in school. This is adults.
See, because I would think self-reporting would actually inflate the number.
Well, almost certainly does, but
0.7%. Oh, no.
So essentially, despite 2 or 3 years in school, virtually no one even pretends that they learned to speak it very well. There's plenty of fluent people in this country, but they don't learn it in school. They learn it in the home. They learn it from living in other countries. And this is the fruit of 2 or 3 years of making someone study language. The instruction is god awful,
right?
But it's just what you would expect, given that you're just trying to torture, you know, basically just trying to torture people, make them ram something down their throats. They're not interested, and they're never going to use it again. So even if they wanted to remember it, they'd have to be practicing all the time in order to keep it up. Because, you know, as I quote Tiger Mom Amy Chu in the book, every day you don't practice is a day you get worse, and that is very well established.
Right. And if you're not intrinsically motivated to learn things, but they're being, you know, crammed into your mind when, you know, certainly that mental RAM could be better allocated to something else. Not only is there resentment, but so there's a negative attitude, but there's also not going to be the practice or the re-engagement. So it really is just, gosh, you know, wasting people's time and money, as you say on the cover of the book.
And just sheer bullying. I think there's a lot of bullying. Yeah. I will say, like, probably my worst educational experience was Spanish 3, where I had a teacher who was very abusive, not physically, but just the sheer way that she lorded it over us and gave us these stupid assignments. Yeah, every month you had to write and then memorize and recite in front of the whole class a speech in Spanish. Because that's the way that you learn a language, is by memorizing a 5-minute speech and then reciting it.
Right.
Just terrible. I can't believe that this was done. Anyway, so I think Washington State has actually switched to, you can do a computer language in lieu of a foreign language. But again, striking that this is not, there's no sign this is catching on or anything. But, just like the slightest concession to modernity. I think we could honestly get to a world where simultaneous translation via Skype type software, we could get to a world where it was totally flawless, and yet we would still make kids learn foreign languages. It's that crazy.
Oh, I believe it. Yeah, absolutely. So, and it sounds like, we had very similar experiences in Spanish class. I was terrible. Being called on, like when you just used to get called on randomly in class, that was a surefire way to be embarrassed in front of 30 people. Yeah. But Brian, thank you so much for the conversation. I really appreciate it. Can you just say the title of the book and where people can get it and where people can learn more about your work in general?
Yeah, absolutely. So the title is The Case Against Education, and just get it from Amazon. It's only $20. So can you really afford not to buy this book? You desperately need it. And if you want to learn more about me, so I blog for EconLog. And I also have tons of stuff up on my website, which is just bkaplan.com, BCAPLAN.
Yeah, awesome resource. And I only first heard about you, I think, a couple of years ago on the subject of immigration. And I've really enjoyed your work and watching you do interviews. I thought you were great on Dave Rubin. So I would I really appreciate you coming on the show and sharing all of this. And I'd love to have you back sometime in the future.
All right. Awesome. By the way, on that note, I've actually got a new book on immigration coming out next year. It's going to be a nonfiction graphic novel.
Oh.
So on the science and philosophy of immigration. And it's drawn by my first choice in all the world to draw it. So if you know the webcomic Saturday Morning Breakfast Cereal, he said some great education related cartoons, by the way. So if you haven't seen it, you got to. Anyway, so drawn by a guy named Zach Wienersmith, and he is drawing my book.
That's awesome. Very, very cool. Thank you so much, Brian, for coming on the show, and we'll talk again soon.
All right, my pleasure. Thanks a lot. Everybody needs an education.